Welcome to Acid Horizon, the theory podcast. It is not just in our minds, as the term is conventionally understood, but it is in our soul, the psyche, where the font of the imagination flows, that we traverse a shifting landscape of sprawling forests, frost-laden fields, the rolling dunes of an imagined Gobi or Sahara, the bottomless blue of the seven numinous seas, and shimmering worlds not yet seen by naked eyes. But we also wonder, have philosophy, psychology, and hitherto phenomenology been perennial saboteurs of the imagination in their imperious demands for things like bases, first principles, and a universal image of thought to guide our inquiry of the domain where dreams, fantasies, and visions are produced? A question: how can we best imagine the nature and activity of the imagination in a manner which does not obscure or snuff out the candle of poetic reverie? Today on Acid Horizon, we are joined by Catherine Everett to plumb the depths of our collective imagination by exploring the meditations of Gaston Bachelard and sections of his 1958 masterpiece, The Poetics of Space. Catherine is a PhD candidate at the European Graduate School, and she is also active on Theory Twitter with the rest of us. And when we first reached out to her, we thought we were going to talk about Hegel. However, in a pleasant turn of events, and no shade on Hegel here, we decided to look at Bachelard's work, which is featured in Catherine's current research alongside Hegel and others. But I'm going to leave it to Catherine to introduce her interests in writing. With that said, Catherine, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Craig, and thank you as well, Adam. I feel so humbled to be here. I'm just really grateful to have this conversation, particularly about one of my absolute favorite texts. But like you said, Craig, my research interests are primarily with Hegel, but specifically with space. And my work focuses on looking at space and Hegel, its relationship with nothingness, the void. Particularly, I look at space in the science of logic, philosophy of nature, and philosophy of mind. And I try and, let's say, suture the three texts together through an analysis of space as ground. And so for me, space is such a fun and interesting problem to consider because it's not synonymous with nothing. And yet we can see some sort of relationship between the two. To me, space is this fascinating ground, this, in terms of ontology, this ground of being. That in itself is, if we think of just space in itself, it's something totally indifferent from which differences arise. So on this very basic level, I find space fascinating. The Bachelard text is a very particular examination of space. And when I first read this text, it sort of like resonated and just like stayed in the back of my mind for so long. And it's not a text I actively work on necessarily, but one that really, it just twists your heart up. This text, I don't know about you when you read it, but whenever I read, this text, other Bachelard texts, there's this visceral reaction I have. Just my gut wrenches, my heart twists. I think the first time I read Bachelard, it was in, Earth and Reveries of Will. And I just read the gravity section of that text. It was assigned for a class. And I remember feeling nauseous while reading this text because it was all about gravity and vertigo and falling. I remember being like, oh my God, am I going to puke?
Without a doubt, this guy was tapped in.
Yeah. Right?
I think the word visceral really captures what's happening in the text. And he's articulating those subliminal thoughts that we have about our own imagination, especially the concept of the daydream, which is something that we'll definitely get into. But him being able to navigate the texture of the daydream in so many different ways and through so many different images really gives you a sense that this is real research, but it's a very different kind of phenomenological research. But I don't want to cut you off.
No.
Please continue.
You're spot on, right? And just like in the text where we do have this very physical reaction to reading it, right? I do think it's hard not to read Bachelard and feel twisted up inside. This is precisely what he's talking about, right? This is his examination of the poetic image and how it has an affect, how it does have an ontological standing beyond just in the imagination, beyond logos, really. And he demonstrates this by saying, look, you feel an immensity within you when you look at or when you imagine an immense sea. You can also feel very small at the same time. And so this exploration of let's call it, for lack of a better word, of this physical affect, this is what he's likewise inducing in you as you read. So I think it's brilliant. I think he does this in a really brilliant way, and in a way that not a lot of authors write. It's just so, again, poetic, and yet very, you know, he's presenting an argument as well with the text.
These days, when I hear the word phenomenology, my hackles go up, right? When you confront Bachelard's work, it's clear that he's doing something different. And and he gives away the game a couple of times in this text. What he says is that the image and the imagination as this creative font is variational, whereas the concept is fixed. And so there's a tension here. If we approach the imagination philosophically, we have not only two different modalities, but in a sense, almost two different substances, two different motivations that tend to work against each other in some ways. And so I see him at odds with a sort of constituent form of phenomenology that relies upon positing some sort of solid subjectivity. Mm-hmm. That's not here. And he admits to that quite often. And one of the ways that he carries you through the text is he reintroduces the imagination and its concept as this sort of variational matrix throughout to show you that even what he's doing in his process, if we want to call it constructing an image of thought, it's always on tenuous grounds, or it's always coming to pass in virtue of the fact that the imagination itself is variational, as he says at the very beginning.
I also would say as well, one of the things that I found so surprising to this as someone who's not particularly well-versed in phenomenology is how it sort of takes that main impulse of phenomenology, what Husserl said as the impulse to go back to the things themselves, the experiences themselves, but it also rejects one of the fundamental sort of grounding philosophers of that tradition, which is Descartes, who isn't necessarily dealing with the things themselves. He's dealing with them from the perspective of this standing back, this detached thinking thing. And even going from that, moving from a thinking thing to considering the nature of an experiencing thing. Bachelard isn't going to let you do that. I mean, this book is kind of, from what I've read of it so far, is like the philosophical experience of like a come up. It's like a drug experience. You can't stand detached from it at any point. You have to simply sit with it. Otherwise, you're going to start, you know, you're not tweaking, you're peaking, essentially. He's bringing you to this philosophical peak. It is all about an intensity of the experience and not the extension of that experience as it extends into categories of thought, but in a sense, an examination of the volume, how much space it takes up without changing how much more space is taken up by that. It's this really fascinating sort of critique of the detached mode of phenomenology as we typically think of it.
I love it. There's so much great stuff that we just put on the table already to work with, from the openness of the imagination that's not fixed that you spoke about, Craig, to what you just said, Adam, about the intensity of experience that sort of defies these rigid categories. I think just some nice context for Bachelard that I think will help inform this conversation. When we think about the work outside of this text, I mean, Bachelard primarily was interested in the scientific epistemology and the philosophy of science. And I mean, he's writing in the early 20th century when there's so many interesting scientific developments happening. And we can all kind of fill in the blanks there in terms of general relativity theory. And later on, he becomes interested in what today we call quantum physics. But one of his, I think, really important contributions to the field in terms of like scientific thought that we see here in this text is on discontinuity. And so he writes in this really wonderful text, Dialectics of Duration, he writes about discontinuity in this text, and it's very much a response to Bergson. And in this really beautiful line in this text, he says, of Bergsonism, we accept everything but continuity. Which is such a great critique of Bergson, because Bergson's all about continuity in so many ways. We could think about like Einstein's train and this, you know, critique of simultaneity that were emerging in the early 20th century. I do think this influences Bachelard. And in this text, Dialectics of Duration, he writes about our experience of time is not a constant linear motion, right? We have these discontinuous episodes where we're in what he calls repose, we're relaxing, we're zoning out, we're thinking about something else. And just phenomenologically, we can all relate to this, right? That I don't have a constant stream of consciousness. There are moments I just totally forget about in my life that I'll never recall. And so for him, I mean, he's a strong dialectical thinker in this way, that there is this relationship between discontinuity and actual events or actual happenings that produce a continuity. So why do I mention this in relationship to science? I mention this because this is likewise his critique of scientific thought, that scientific thought is not emerging in this progressive linear fashion. We build upon these blocks in a very steady way, but that it's very discontinuous. He calls these epistemological obstacles, epistemological breaks. And so, I mean, we can see how this, he was so influential in the 20th century, particularly for French thinkers. Based on what I just said, I mean, we can see this resonate in Foucault, for example, right? Foucault directly picks up what Bachelard says about epistemological obstacles and breaks in the continuity of thought. And likewise, Althusser popularizes this expression, right? The epistemological break, when he talks about Marx's sixth thesis on Feuerbacher. But the reason I bring this up is that, like what you guys just talked about as well, was on resonated with discontinuity in the openness of the subject. But then there's the secondary point that Adam made on this intensity of experience that defies categories. But I bring up discontinuity as well to tie this in, because the experience that he refers to, the poetic image, is something that emerges out of nowhere for him. It has no cause. And when I first read this text, I thought, okay, that's a really bold claim. How can this poetic image have no cause? But he makes what I think is a strong argument in this regard. I'll stop there, but there's more to say. But I feel like I just gave you a nice little nugget to work with.
No, I think this is a fantastic and interesting part of his problematic, because there's a manner in which the positing of the image for him maps onto, and not to bring Deleuze in too early here, but what he's talking about is a kind of production of newness, a production of an exactness or a thisness. It almost corresponds to the distinction between hexaity and aquidity. And so every image is a kind of hexaity insofar as its very own specificity defies, in some sense, the notion of causality. It comes from somewhere. And one of his primary interlocutors in this text, especially in the introduction as we read it, is Carl Jung, who also espoused his own notion of acausality. And it's through the notion of the acausal that we're able to think, in Jung's terms, the idea of synchronicity. And even the idea of reverberation, or we could even use the word resonance, is dependent upon the very specificity of an image, kind of breaking with the causal order. And Bachelard doesn't say this specifically, but I think one of the things that's operating in the background of his thought is that every image, insofar as we notice it, is a kind of lure, a lure to think alongside of it. And we mutually entify with the image. He thinks of images as entities, in a way. And maybe one of the ways that he doesn't cross swords with Bergson is that there's a sense in which we could say that everything is an image in this world. And it's a matter of how the cut of each one of these images intersect. And one of the standout sentences in, I think it's in the section or the chapter entitled Home, where he talks about two images coming into conversation with one another, where an image loses, the only way that an image loses its anarchy is through this kind of poetic contestation of two images coming together, whether that's in the competing or contesting voices of two poets, two poetic expressions, or maybe a piece of art paired with some sonorous piece of music, then constructing another image. He doesn't really use the metaphor of combat, but I like thinking about the image as these contestations of existing images that force the creation of the new.
Yeah, I think that was really well said. When it comes to this idea of like production of newness and the discontinuity through which the image emerges, I think we need to ask ourselves, like, what does he really mean by this, right? What does it mean that the image is just completely new? It has no cause. He also calls the poetic image a pure sublimation, right? Ooh, that there's this something created from nothing. And I think what Bachelet's really referring to, I mean, when we read the text, we can gather a poetic image, or we can generate a poetic image from reading poetry, right? From encountering, let's say in the book, she talks about one author encountering a nest in the woods. But likewise, they can really come from nowhere, right? I can will myself to imagine my childhood home, or my childhood home could just come to me in my mind without me necessarily like positively willing it to come into my mind. So there's this question of like, where does this image come from? How is it generated? Sometimes there are causes for him, but likewise, we can imagine, and we do imagine, right, that there are, it's just newness that comes into our mind, or oldness, places that we return to sometimes, just when we need comfort, for example, when we're fantasizing. But this is, I think it's one of the more interesting and relevant points in the book, is the eruption of the image, because like we said, it has to do with discontinuity, but it's also evental, right? It's this event that creates a new world that doesn't have a link to something before. You can see my hidden Badoozy in the side here, haha. But I think this for me is one of the most compelling aspects of the book.
So one question I just have as well, sort of for me, someone who's sort of uninitiated also for the benefit of the listeners as well as myself, is so when Bachelard is saying that the poetic images do not have a cause, so let's unpack this. So to not have a cause also means to not be in effect. And therefore, if images aren't effects because they're uncaused, then therefore they do not refer back to a previous thing which brings them into being in like a necessary connection. Right, there is no beginning to the image, and therefore they have no past. So when he says that these images do not have a cause, is he eliminating the mention of the past, partially because he wants to think of images as something which cannot be past or future, but only ever present, only ever intense, and not to deal with an extension in terms of a period of time? And in doing so, I mean, how does this fit into where he talks about the productive imagination? Because if you're talking about production of pure presence, is there a past production? Is there no history of production? I mean, this category of the imagination and causality is so central to a lot of the previous philosophies, especially in Central Europe. I mean, Kant has a theory of the imagination. It's what the whole Critique of Judgment's about. I mean, Kant actually, in the Critique of Pure Reason, has this whole, you know, he struggles with, does he want to stick with a theory of productive imagination, which he does in the A deduction of the categories, and this is definitely getting more esoteric as I'm talking about it, but, or does he want to go to a theory of reproductive imagination? And Bachelard's intervention in this is that typically we only ever think of the imagination as something in which we reproduce images, or we reproduce memories, or we maintain memories, or we imagine things when prompted from, you know, say, like when you think of hypotheticals, for example, imagine a horse or something, you know, imagine a square circle. But he wants to take us to this central, really hard to describe, I guess, in language point, where I guess we have to invent new linguistic terms for this themselves. And maybe that is his argument, in a way, in that by trying to articulate this kind of experience in the presence of the image, we therefore are taken back to a literal poetics, in the sense of we have to start making up new words to explain it, which nonetheless do not refer to a previous, but there is this discontinuity as you're talking about. So just am I getting the sense in which these are acausal? Because when people say, when we're moving from these images aren't caused, but then we talk about being produced, there's a sort of, there's somewhat of a tension there, because it's easy to think of cause as just that thing which precedes that other thing, and we're sort of, it's hard to maintain that temporal thread. So if there's this continuity here, how does that fit in with the language of production, which is about, I guess, you know, ducts, like tear ducts, or water ducts, aqueducts. It's about direction as much as it is about sort of temporality at the same time.
So I think the question of acausality is a big one. And we just sort of talked about, you know, you can produce a poetic image from one's own experience, one's childhood home, right? So clearly there is a past to certain poetic images. There also can be just like the purely imaginary, imagine a completely vast and open sea that we might have a reference point for. But I do think while these images for him lack a cause in the sense that they can just spring to our minds and we can explore them in a way that just unfolds, I think that they likewise are really central for Bachelard's discussion of future, right? So they do have effect, right? They do have effect on us, like physically, emotionally. There's an ontological standing of the poetic image. But this is also his like break with the axon, right? Is that the imagination opens us up to the future. And this is also his link to freedom, which is, I think, a really one of the most beautiful parts of the text too, that in order to be free, we need to imagine. We need to be able to consider something outside of ourselves. And this is why the text is on space as well, right? Why it's not on something else, right? Because space is what, I mean, if space weren't open, if space weren't continuous and indeterminate, then we wouldn't be able to think of a future. I mean, this is like such a critical piece here. But you raise this, I mean, you raise a great question, right? Like, what does this acausality mean? And I think it's about the emergence of the image, that it's emergent from language, he says, and yet above language, that it stands on its own two legs, that we don't need to use signifiers and words to describe these images. Like, we could all think of our childhood home right now, and I could sort of describe it, right? Like, oh, there's a staircase I went up, you know, and it's a really big staircase I climbed. But this is why he pushes back against psychoanalysis as well, right? That we're overanalyzing these images and tying signifiers in when we should just sit with this viscerality, with this actual emotion. So yeah, no, Adam, I think you raised a really important question. I'm sure there's other people that probably even explain this in like a better way. But I do think the acausality is an attempt to allow the image to stand on its own, but very much to point to the future as well, and to allow us to open up the possible.
I pulled a quote from Bachelard here that I think will avail us. And I'm glad that you pointed out psychoanalysis and psychology more broadly. One of the things that the poetic act, the creativity that lies within accessing our imagination, as you said, Catherine, involves making this break with the order of signification, this kind of rupture. For example, psychoanalysis, whether it's Freudian, Lacanian, Jungian, posits any sort of rigid categories, which, I mean, arguably, I know most about Jungian psychology, and there's debates about whether the archetypes are sort of real, reified things, or are they more like thresholds of thought or tendencies or what have you. Bachelard certainly has something to say about it. And just to address Adam's question about acausality, the question of an image's communicability is really what pins this down. And so this quote that I pulled might help us out. So in Bachelard's words, to say that the poetic image is independent of causality is to make a rather serious statement. But the causes cited by psychologists and psychoanalysts can never really explain the wholly unexpected nature of the new image, any more than they can explain the attraction it holds for a mind that is foreign to the process of its creation. The poet does not confer the past of his or her or their image upon me, and yet their image immediately takes root in me. The communicability of an unusual image is, in fact, of great ontological significance. Of course it is. We shall return to this question of communion, though brief, isolated, rapid actions. Images excite us afterwards, but they are not the phenomenon of an excitement. That, I think, is interesting. In all psychological research, we can, of course, bear in mind psychoanalytical methods for determining the personality of a poet and thus find the measure of the pressures, but above all, of the oppressions that a poet has been subjected to in the course of his life. But the poetic act itself, the sudden image, the flare-up of being in the imagination, are accessible to such investigations. In order to clarify the problem of the poetic image philosophically, we shall have to have recourse to a phenomenology of the imagination. By this should be understood a study of the phenomenon of the poetic image when it emerges into consciousness as a direct product of heart, soul, and being of man, woman, or person apprehended in their actuality. And I mean, there's a way in which this particular paragraph, I think, begs the question a little bit, but I would say, or at least I would argue, that there is a dimension of the imagining that resists a kind of communication that enjoins us to sit, like you said, Catherine, with the viscerality of the image. But at the same time, Bachelard also says that this poetic act does create a kind of rupture, a sort of towering light erupts through the crust of the earth. And what it does is it forms its own order. It has a sort of law-giving capacity in the sort of Nietzschean Deleuzian sense that it creates something new to which extant signification must respond to. So when the poet creates, of course, it is a new event, but then the condensation or the desiccation of that then falls upon the existing symbolic order. But I don't know. What do you think, Catherine?
Yeah. On the one hand, there's an uncommunicability of the image it's an interesting tension, right? Because he's very much dialectical kind of approach here, right? Let me, give you poetic images through poetry, through language, but allow something to emerge that is beyond language itself, that is beyond logos. So hence, as you said, like there's this inability to communicate necessarily the image in my head. And yet these images are transsubjective, he says, that we can all sit here and think about the immense ocean. And there's a good chance we're going to have a similar feeling. We'll be able to describe that feeling in a similar way, right? I myself am immense, or I myself am small. So he is doing something structural nonetheless, right? He is saying that there is something shared amongst us in this exploration of space. But nonetheless, there's something that goes beyond the word, right? And I think this is one of the more important claims he's making as well in the text, right? That the ontological standing of the poetic image is, I said it before, but I want to say it again, that the poetic image is emergent from language and yet above language. Now, what does he mean? I mean, this is something really, what does he mean by this, right? We could really talk about it, but I think it's evident when you read it, the image that he elicits that goes beyond the word itself. And again, he's trying to give this image its own ontological dignity, right? What is it in itself? And to go back to that Adam brought up, I mean, this is in a way a really, he calls it in the introduction, the subject and object are in this iridescent back and forth, in this almost reverberation between the two. And when we think of the poetic image, I mean, what a great entanglement of subject and object. We have an object of thought, but in a sense, this is our subjectivity that we're talking about, right? The ability to imagine. And so we can kind of see this back and forth with the image itself.
He creates this concept, or at least uses this term, of microphenomenology, which I thought was fascinating. And I like the term that you use, Catherine, that we give a sort of ontological dignity to the image. I use the word entification, that in our acknowledgement or notice of this image and in the casting off of whatever cladding we have in order for us to be receptive to images, that we then create this dialectical relationship that then is consubstantial between the image and the poet. And it's almost as if little particles are shooting off the image and the creator themselves to construct each other. He calls this a microphenomenology. There's a similar concept to this, a minor becoming, perhaps, that's maybe less dialectical. And in fact, in A Thousand Plateaus, Deleuze and Guattari, they kind of go after Bachelard here. I think really who they're going after is Hegel. They're going after the dialectical aspect of Bachelard. But what they are trying to say, I think, is still nonetheless similar, is that in this constructive event, this poeticizing of the image, there is a kind of exchange that takes place that is not at the molar or the subjective level as we ordinarily understand it. It's happening quietly, imperceptibly. When we become immense, it might defeat or overcome our immediate notice of it. Like suddenly in this creative act, we have become immense. I mean, the way that I imagine it is a sort of transition from an ordinary state of consciousness, for example, to this slow glide into this phenomenological difference, this new space that the old sense cannot really take part in. And so I think this is one of the reasons that I question the sort of dialectical nature of things, and maybe I cleave to my Deleuzian commitments there, that there is something created that's new. It's almost like a third vector.
I mean, one of the things I'm stuck with, I guess, or not stuck with, but just ruminating on how different Bachelard's method is that particularly in terms of the history of thinking about experience in modern European philosophy, we think about space and time in particular, going back to Kant, they're not things that are found, they are found in experience, but at the same time, they're also conditions for the production of experience that precede our experience. We need these we can only receive experience for Kant under conditions of space and time. because for Kant, we need time so that two contradictory things can happen at once, and therefore we can spread them across times. And we need space, which is demonstrable by the fact of Euclidean geometry for Kant. And both are a priori, you know, they're before experience, but nonetheless the conditions of our experience, the anything. And what Bachard is doing here, it seems, is he's suspending the distinction between the a priori and the a posteriori, between what is pre and after experience. And he's also doing something which kind of not possibly even doing that sort of transcends or at least avoids sort of Kantian problematics by essentially placing space before time as a necessary condition of our experience of images, first and foremost. And this can't help but remind me of Hegel's philosophy of nature, because rather than the condition of, you know, Hegel's philosophy of nature, you know, I mean, me and Catherine have been talking about this before, you know, it doesn't start with time. That's the weird thing. It starts with space. And because the reason why it starts with space is because the condition of nature, of objectivity, or of experience of objects, is space for otherness to enter upon the scene, for otherness to appear before us. The appearance is actually first and foremost about otherness than it is about avoiding contradiction. There is otherness before there is, I was about to say logic, but it doesn't work for Hegel because the size of logic is what produces this sort of spurting out into otherness. And I just wanted to ask about how does this get relate, I guess, between Bachelard and Hegel? Because there's this suspension of the distinction which is so structural for so much of philosophy, which is the a priori and the a posteriori. And then at the same time, there's this sort of sub or priority given to space in a way in which it's kind of reverses or attempts to avoid the centrality of time to the structure of subjectivity. And I think this might go some, this is solving the original question again on a causality, because there's, at least in introduction, the temporal dimension is something which he's constantly trying to bat off as the first thing in subjectivity. It's about the production of space comes before the production of time, and the production of space is the same thing as production of the image, which I just find got a kind of a fascinating sort of almost revolution in the science of experience of consciousness, to use a Hegelian term.
Yeah, there's so many great things to work with there. I think the first question we need to ask is space that from which being emerges, or is space emergent from being? That's a big question. And it really comes down to what we mean when we say space. Are we talking about the relationship between two objects? Or are we speaking of a completely abstract space without objects in them? So in Hegel, for example, in Science of Logic, he says that we can't think of pure nothing. It is in the first chapter, right? It's impossible. Our thoughts get interrupted immediately, right? We can think about Buddhism here as well, right? You know, like to meditate on a nothingness is to achieve a higher consciousness. But we all know that when we think of pure nothing, eventually we're going to think something else. So back to space, the relationship between things, or is it the ground of relationship itself? So when we look at like what modern quantum physics is saying, right, that space is an emergent property of atomic interactions, that argument is saying that space is relationship between things, right? There are things and now there is relationship between them. But we can also see space as just an indifferent ground that gives rise to differences as well. Right. So there's like two different ways we can look at this, and it depends on what we mean. What is Bachelard doing though? Right. That's my own sort of like interjection with Hegel. But what's Bachelard's point here? He is twisting definitely space in the sort of like external material world and our internal world. And he's saying they actually map onto each other and inform each other and are not so distinct, that my interaction with my spatial surroundings is informed by my own imagination, my own past. But I think one of the more interesting things he's doing is that he's telling us the imagination itself is spatial. And this is not a metaphor. It's not that, oh, my mind is like a house. It's like, you can say, no, when we imagine, when we are in our own heads, we go down corridors, we have cellars, we have attics, we have drawers and corners. And he's pretty firm that he's not talking about metaphor, which is something I think we could also discuss more, right? Like, how are we not talking about metaphor in that sense? But this is, I think, something to dwell on. For Merleau-Ponty, for example, his argument is that because we physically live in a spatial world, our thoughts are therefore spatial. So you see his sort of like causal arrow, right? Now, is that the case? I don't know, right? That's what Merleau-Ponty says. Heidegger, just to throw in all the phenomenologists in here, you know, Heidegger has a very interesting relationship with space. And I really like this point he makes. It's in one of his later texts, Art and Space. He says that we can strip away so much content, right? I can strip away the mic, the computer. I can strip away content. I can strip away time, but I can't strip away space. This is the final curtain, the final sort of phenomenological ground. And when I confront space itself, I feel anxiety, right? I feel angst. Therefore, I am called to thinking, haha, yes. But this goes back to your question, Adam. Is space an a priori? Is it something that we can't subtract? In which case, it seems like we're thinking about nothingness. But then we need to ask, is it marking nothingness that reveals nothingness itself, right? Is it an a posteriori in a sense? And this is like how I take your question. I think this is like the money question, right? Where does space fall? And again, this is kind of, I'm not really talking about text now, but I do think that we can see space as emergent in terms of its relationship between things in this like kind of quantum physics description. And yet there needs to be some indifferent ground for difference as well. I think we can see it in these two different ways. And there's a different inflection in both. Does that make sense, Adam?
Yeah, particularly the indifference aspects are definitely like returning me to my sort of Schillingian sort of sympathies. In terms of the space as an emergent ground of the relationship. I think that's a very powerful argument, particularly about we can strip time away, but we can't strip out space. And I think that's a pretty good rejoinder to Kant specifically, because Kant needs time to fill a certain logical prohibition, whereas with space, it actually fills the absolute, in a sense, because it's indifferent to relation. It's the ground of all, therefore, relation. And it's particularly interesting to bring the quantum physics aspect into this, because that's something I'm not particularly trained in, but it definitely feels like it's reviving some of the more, particularly more romantic impulses of the sort of German sort of like nature philosophy as well, which makes it quite an exciting sort of field of synthesis.
Yeah, no, I think so too. Hence my own little obsession with the quantum physics. I think it does very much relate to the question of the ground itself. But let's take it back to Bachelard maybe, right? That was a fun detour. I love that. I was so here for that detour. I mean, in the introduction, he says that he's going to conduct a topo analysis, right? And he says, I'm only going to touch upon topophilic images and topophilia, right? I'm going to talk about nice images, images that attract us, that make us feel like warm and cozy inside. He said, you can think about spaces of war and conflict some other time. And only a few times in the text does he actually bring up images that repulse us. So, and gosh, I guess I'll just talk about the one now just to totally, just to mess with us. But he does in, I think it's the second to last chapter, talk about space as horrifying in its indeterminate. And it can be horrifying in that there we just don't know what's out there. And yet this is likewise, just in a very broad sense, this is why the world is open. There is possibility, why we can imagine, why there is freedom. I think this really all, like for me, like the openness and freedom links so intrinsically to space in this way. Mm. But anyway, again, I kind of diverge a little bit from the Bachelard.
There's definitely a live, laugh, love sort of vibe to Bachelard, but you have to tack onto that something like you're saying, indeterminacy, uncertainty, openness. One of the terms that I think is lurking around this conversation that we haven't brought up is the idea of intensity versus extension in the world, because the way that we typically think of spatiality is in the extended world. And so Bachelard is forced to make an account of what is happening in the imagination. I mean, we think of the imagination conventionally as interior. I don't think we necessarily have to think of it that way in order to complete this thought. But when we see what we think is reality, the extended world, the objective world, clearly there's a way in which the imagination can override that or be projected upon it or be consubstantial with it in some way as to change it. And I think that is one of the keys to unlocking this idea of acausality. There are other ways that Bachelardians try to solve this problem, like James Hillman, for example. Hillman, for all intents and purposes, I see him as a Neoplatonist. Particularly, he's a follower of Proclus. And I think in conjunction with this idea of causality, we have to make an account of epistemology. Because if there is an acausal dimension to the world, how is it known? Because we know causality through epistemology, right? Through our sense perception, memory, and so forth. The way that Hillman approaches this is by using Proclus and saying that there are different kinds of knowings. There's the aboutness of things, like a sort of quiddity aspect of things. Like, what is that thing? Oh, it's this. But there's also another kind of knowing that ordinarily we don't think as being able to measure, which is a knowing in the soul, a knowing in the psyche, a knowing in the image itself that does resist communication. But instead of going the way of like, oh, it cannot be measured, Hillman and maybe even Proclus, and I'd have to go back and look at Proclus's work, is to expand the notion of measurement and say that there's a way in which we can measure intensities vis-a-vis extension. I think Bachelard does a little bit of this. And unfortunately, I gave the read of the latter chapters maybe a little less time than I should have. But the idea that he puts forward of, for example, immensity, the feeling of immensity is connected with this feeling of intimacy that we often feel in the extended world. But when intimacy crosses this intensive boundary into the imagination, it is felt as an immensity. So there is this sort of dialectical quality there. And I know you spent more time with the text than us, Catherine. So if you want to riff off of that, by all means.
Yeah, I mean, you raised a really interesting question on measurement. I'd like to hear more about that, because I think we are kind of bumping up against like a methodological problem. Measurement is, it's precise, it's quantifiable, it's the signifier. And yet what Bachelard's doing here is he's giving us poetry, but he's saying, just let it emerge, right? Like, let it grab onto your soul. So it is an interesting question of like, how can we measure that? I don't know. I think he just gives us a bunch of different images and poetic lines and says, you feel something from this for a very specific reason though, right? It's not just, you know, fun and games, right? But that we do have, I mean, it's going to sound romantic, but it is romantic, right? We have infinity within us, right? And this is like, you know, so many of us as philosophers are thinking about, how do I put that into logic, right? And he's saying, well, maybe you just let the logic kind of slip through your fingers a bit and feel the immensity through this image. So, I mean, this is why Bachelard is such a gorgeous read, but I think we can intellectualize it as well, certainly. And I think the precise mode through which we can intellectualize it, I'm going to say it again, I think it's space. I really do. I think that in considering the indeterminacy of space, that allows us to think infinity. I mean, like a bad Hegelian infinity, right? It goes on and on forever. But this likewise then offsets the interior infinity, this true infinite in a Hegelian sense. But I think space is this key link, right? And for example, in his chapter the Corners chapter, he writes that the corner is like the corner is the negation of the universe. It's simple, but it's a great point that when we have a determined space that can offset the indeterminacy and the extension and the grandeur of the universe. So just even in this sort of like spatial dialectic that he's putting forth, I think we can't intellectualize and think logically about what it means, what the infinite is. But his entry point is so beautiful in that he's saying, just let it grab you in the stomach first and then think about it.
Right. And I think there's a way that we can talk about the measurement in somewhat certain terms. At least with respect to the imagination, there's a relationality. For example, he in his chapter on the home, for example, he gives us what seems to be a universal template for a childhood home, the way that we think it, the attic and the basement and the garret and so on and so forth. But what he says later is that in subsequent dreams and daydreams, pieces of that home, or maybe a picture in a room, a mirror, a couch or something, will appear in other images and will populate in such a way that it is a reference to that original image. Now, I don't think Bachelard is giving us the hard and fast rules for what the sort of transcendental image of the childhood home looks like. But even within Bachelard's imagination of this home, we're getting a picture of the way that he's thinking and feeling vis-a-vis himself, other concepts and other images that he's presenting. And the question is whether or not there's a resonance with you as the poet, as the imaginer yourself. I mean, I've had dreams where, you know, I can speak rather specifically of it. Carl Jung has this idea of a big dream. When I was very young, I was like 4 years old, one of the biggest dreams that I've had. And it's interesting because I don't have a lot of dreams about my childhood home, but I have lots and lots of dreams about the shopping malls that my parents used to take me to. So that is the true capitalist home, is the shopping mall of the 1980s and 1990s. To make matters worse, my dad used to carry me around the shopping mall, and he used to point to mannequins. And he said, "Do you see that boy over there? He was a bad, bad boy." And I was fucking terrified. And not so long after that, there would be security guards walking around the mall, and he would say, "Do you see those guys over there? They're the guys who capture the bad boys." Now you see where my politics comes from. But anyway, all that to say is I had a dream once where, well, in this dream, basically I'm in the empty shopping mall and I see an escalator. And as soon as I look at the escalator, it turns on. And I go to the base of the escalator and I want to ascend. But what is at the top of the escalator? None other than three mannequins just bobbing at the top. I'm getting chills just thinking about it right now. Bachelard in real time. So the thing is, I've had dreams along the way. Like I had that dream. I remembered it, thought about it a bit as a child. And then sometimes, you know, in a dream, like, I don't know, I'm at a cocktail party. There's a zebra over there. And I walk and I open the door and there are the three mannequins again. And so it's as if that image from that incipient big dream in my life has fragmented and flung itself across my imagination, whereupon I encounter elements of it throughout my life. And so there is this sort of substrate of images moving along with me as I navigate my way towards death and complete all the poetic tasks in the meantime. But like, there is something there in which I think a kind of measurement can take place. But of course, it's not a quantification. It's this shifting relational quality between various images.
I think that was a great example. And I laughed a little bit about the mannequins.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, who wouldn't? It's yeah.
But I think Bachelard speaks directly to this when he talks about the repetition of the daydream, the repetition of the image. And this connects back to when we spoke about continuity and discontinuity, that when we repeat certain daydreams or actual, you know, night dreams, that these different repetitions allow us to thread together a sort of narrative of experience, you could say, right? Or just experience itself to give solidity and continuity to my very discontinuous self in discontinuous experience. And the repetition here, I think, yeah, we could talk about Deleuze, we could talk about Lacan when it comes to repetition. I mean, it's Kierkegaard, right? A beautiful theme. But for Bachelard, I think it has a lot to do with rhythm, right? This reverberation of the image in with us. And this, again, I think has to do with these breaks and these discontinuities that then give rise to continuity. But he sees, and I know Deleuze talks about rhythm and reverberation as well. I mean, it's a really beautiful theme. Nancy talks about reverberation and the trembling of the negative when he reads Hegel, right, in terms of dialectical movement. And this is really critical to Bachelard. In this text, we see it, but really in his overall oeuvre is the what he calls rhythm analysis of subjectivity. So that's it. When I hear that you're having these repeated dreams of the 1980s, 1990s mall, this is structuring your subjectivity, Craig. it's part of you.
Busted. Yeah, that's right. No, I agree. And I think, you know, if we're going to talk about Deleuze a little bit, there is something that Bachelard and Deleuze share in common, which is not a complete distrust or disdain for dreams, but certainly they understand that the aleatory dream that we experience as we sleep is something that is ripe for the picking for the psychoanalyst. Whereas the daydream puts us in this space where our conscious mind, and if we want to call it the unconscious or imaginal flow, and the sort of liminal or porous space that stands between them. And it's not necessarily that we have more control, but with the daydream, well, Bachelard says that to be a poet, to create a poem, is to be, to work with the substance of the daydream. Like, there's not that much different outside of perhaps taking a more of an active role, putting images together and creating a world. Whereas, you know, some daydream, there's some illicit daydreams, of course, that just kind of like, I don't know, are more interruptive or pass us by. Whereas, but all of that content, like if you look at, you know, somebody like Carl Jung, or probably more specifically James Hillman, that even that fleeting imagination that we have has something within it that could, or maybe even wants, to be tarried with. And it's in those fleeting moments that we're invited to create.
There's one question I have, which is, in the realms of philosophy, you know, there's a temptation, he does say in later chapters of this book, are predominantly have metaphysical implications. But it seems like, in terms of wider methodology, that what Bachelard is doing is essentially trying to produce a new kind of physics. What I mean by this is, because one of the key sort of terms in his sort of description of his project, and phenomenology has, or you know, typically does try to present itself as a new kind of science, a unique kind of scientific methodology, which is, he uses the terms force and dynamics. And this goes back to, I mean, this is a long tradition of the critique of Newtonian mechanics, mechanics generally. So, for example, Kant, later on in his Nature Philosophy, he moves from a mechanics to a dynamics. The entire Schlingian Nature Philosophy is basically dynamic. Goethean science moves from mechanics to dynamics. And this move from mechanics to dynamics is essentially a move from this linear causality, or like to take the example from Hume, the billiard balls, one ball hits another, that is nature of cause effect. It is linear across time. Two extended bodies collide, one produces an effect, and of which the preceding one is the cause. Instead, dynamics, a shift in dynamics, the shift towards force beyond extension. So just to give an example for listeners of a dynamic reading of, for example, physics. So a mechanistic version takes atoms as its basic concepts, and those interact, and those cause causal interactions across time and space. For a dynamic version, at least in my understanding of 19th century German conceptions thereof, they try to think about the conditions of possibility of atoms, of these units, which is a unity, a certain ratio or quantitative sort of aspect of attractive and repulsive forces, where an attractive force is held back by, so a repulsive force projects it outside, an attractive force retracts it back to itself, keeps it inside, and that is the force which creates these units. And therefore, underneath mechanism is a dynamism of a motion of forces which gets into sort of metastable appearances, which seem to us like strict, discrete, mechanistic units. This is, in my right understanding, for Bachelard, this is what he's trying to do with images, insofar as he's not looking at them mechanistically, but dynamically. And how does this concept of force, where is this taking him? Because in the experiential sense, it's very sort of, it's not just intuitive. It's, I mean, this is the example I give whenever I'm talking about force. You know, listener, you are now thinking of an elephant. You are now breathing manually. Do not think of an elephant. The result is the same as me telling you to think of an elephant. It is that force of experience of, you cannot move the experience out. The experience forces itself. And you know, there's this kind of a repulsion of the subject trying to maintain itself, not to be totally overcome by this image, not to be totally wiped out in this experience of itself. But there's also the attraction of experience under which an experience is, in a sense, homogenous with the thing that experiences it. And so I'm wondering, is this the door, not the door, like bloody 70 years ago, but is this the attempt of a new physics of the imagination, as opposed to a metaphysics that sort of supersedes the conditions of possibility of the imagination?
What a small question. Really, I mean, it's fascinating. I think my just off-the-cuff reaction to what you said, Adam, is that in terms of like the tension between force and attraction and repulsion, Bachelard is telling us, I'm going to look at images that attract us, right? But then in the genesis of the image, this is the question of force, I think, coming into it, right? Are we forced to think of the elephant? Or is it, does it come to us externally when I read a poem? Or more interestingly, right, can we think of force in a Hegelian way, like as a resolve, right? Can I sit here and will myself to think of the childhood home, to think of the immense sea that then attracts me or repulses me? So I think there's this element of freedom that does play a role, and it is very much a question of like the ground of force and this very basic physics question, right? But we also see attraction and repulsion playing a role in here. So is Bachelard telling us how the imagination works in these really raw ways? I mean, he doesn't lay it out flat for us, right? And say like, it's this, this, and that, right? There's definitely, I think we can read into it like we're doing right now, like this exploration of where do these images come from and what do they elicit within us? What is their ontological standing? And Craig has brought this up a few times, right? That there is like a connection between the interior and the exterior in this way that our imagination shapes our external world in many ways. And there's a lot to back that up with. But yeah, that's my reaction to what you said. I feel like I missed something though.
The dialect of the inside and the outside is absolutely how he tries to cash this out. And it's one of those things especially that makes it seem particularly resonant with a dialectical reading. Yeah, because the implicit, explicit, I mean, even going back to Hegel's, like, even his theory of quantity itself, you know, like the whole, like, he starts with the one and the void. Even that, he can't get away from the spatial dimension internal to the very logic of the term the sea itself. And so to have the term image presupposes space before it can, you know, these images need a space to appear before they can even become contradictory, in a sense. It's not that limits imagination at time, limits imagination is a spatial aspect. So I completely agree.
Maybe one thing to add with respect to attraction and repulsion, and to answer Adam's question about mechanism and dynamism, like Carl Jung, Bachelard believes that within the imaginal dimension, attraction and repulsion kind of have an absolute value, where the feeling of repulsion is almost isomorphic with the feeling of attraction, imagistically speaking. Like the nature of the pull is the same, whereas maybe the quality or the experience or judgment of it is different. Jung says something quite similar. Like, so for example, in a dream, you can't think in a negative. You never have a dream image that is a negation of that image. Everything is presented in a sort of positive dimension. And it's only when we think of things in terms of the extended world or the image of thought that undergirds the extended world that we have this positive and negative charge or inflection to any given image. I mean, this is part of the problematic of Deleuze too. If we want to talk about topophilia, we can talk about the topographic nature of opposition undergirded by what transcendental subjectivity that itself is purely positive. There is something like that happening here. And of course, Hegelians and Deleuzians are going to butt heads on that. But in any case, Catherine, maybe you want to follow that up, but I do want to ask you about your work too.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's such a resonance here with the Deleuze, with the Deleuze and Guattari. I mean, I was looking at the cinema texts and trying to make some connections with what Bachelard's doing. And in the second cinema text, they directly reference Bachelard and talk about the mutual image, right? And this is what we've been talking about, right? The dialectics of inside and outside, that there is this actuality to the virtual and a virtuality to the actual, right? That each contains the germ of the other in a sense, or each other, sort of co-constituted. It's a simplification, but this is we can see Bachelard very much, I think, in their work as well. But yeah, that's just my immediate reaction to the Deleuze piece. But so many interesting questions here. And I do want to just like bring it back to space though, right? That we can really think so much about what is the imagination, what is the poetic image, but this exploration of space, I just can't stress how critical it is in terms of, like Adam was even saying, that even when we read the logic, we need a space to think logic in. We need some sort of logical space. We need to mark the void in some sense, or we need a void to name, right? If we read Badu, for example. But it's very difficult for us to again, back to Heidegger, right? To escape space. Can we escape space? Can we think without space at all? I don't know. But there's certainly, when we look at space in this sort of rendering of what space is, right? And again, we have different sort of definitions of space, especially when we think in a naturalistic sense. So what we're really talking about when we talk about space is we're just talking about the ground of determination, right? We're saying, how do we determine things? How do we talk about difference? We need to have some sort of indifference, some sort of indetermination that informs that. This is a very dialectical reading. Oh, my hands are up, I admit it. But this is what allows Bachelard to take us through these visceral images of space that's a whole beautiful piece of it, but that allow us to determine ourselves, to determine the world, that there's an indeterminacy with us, within us, as well as externally. And this is how we can determine things. And so this is why space is so critical for Bachelard, in contrast to Bergson, right? With the, in terms of thinking the future. And I've said it before, but I just really feel like it's important to emphasize in the ability to be free, right? Is to have space. And if we didn't have, space in itself, like this, I think just underlines the fact that the world is open. It has to be, because it is spatial.
This then takes me to the question about your work. Is this a theme that you're developing in your dissertation then?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think, all of us and more. Particularly for me, the question that I'm asking is simply, what is space in an ontological sense, right? In a very grounded sense. And what sort of led me to this question was when I was reading, I found so many interesting discussions on time. So many, especially like having a strong foot like with the Slovenes and like the Lacanian school, I found the notion of like apliku and naftalik so interesting, this sort of like retroactive temporal constitution. But I thought to myself, we're not really discussing space. And while there is topological analysis, for example, in Lacan, and the topologies that get flirted with in texts like Lefebvre on the production of space, we don't really have simply a text on what is space itself. And so for me, it just links into so many important discussions, again, in terms of difference, determination. And so what I'm trying to do is, again, link together logic, nature, and spirit in like the Hegelian register of how can we sort of distinguish like three spaces, let's say. How do they suture together?
I'm curious if there's any sort of practical ways that you think working with these ideas cashes out, at least notably. I reflect upon the work of James Hillman. He works a lot with the concept of space. I mean, a very, very sort of simple problematic. If you go into any office building that has cubicles, we see the fluorescent lights, which are completely utilitarian, almost exceedingly utilitarian, especially those particular lights that only illuminate the space in which the workers walk within. Like there's tons of lights up there and they have little mirrors, little slatted mirrors that are in the space of the fluorescent lights. But if you look up, there's still darkness on the ceiling somehow. And one of the things that Hillman pointed out is that, well, in modernity, we have stopped looking up. We don't have a profuse amount of ornate moldings and cornice work and that sort of thing. And one of the ways that Hillman wants to re-inject soul within the world is by paying attention to what's above. Like, let's lift our heads up, because clearly the office space, broadly construed, is now pushing our heads down to the desk, to the laptop, to the keyboard. I'm wondering if there's any ways that you've thought similarly, or that you're utilizing these ideas to think about practical matters in the world today.
Yeah, gosh, ask a philosopher how practical her ideas are. I know. Oh, I've been caught. No, certainly. So my intention has been to really look at the ground of space from there to examine like a sort of sociological, let's say, like offshoots, right? So I think you pointed to some really great examples. And just to like link it back to Bachelard for a moment, we can see in this very philosophical discussion of determinacy and indeterminacy that when I have a small corner, cozy nook to work in, I can really allow myself to be expansive because I determined a little space for myself that allows me to be vague. Likewise, I could be in the middle of a vast desert and feel that immensity and that smallness. So there is like a sociological implication of this. And I mean, this text is huge for architects, right? If you're in like architecture design, this is one of your kind of philosophical touch points. It's very popular in this community. And I think it's influenced so many people. So yeah, no, I do think my work on space, even though it can seem very like from a hermeneutic or just very philosophical in a way, has these important sociological offshoots. But for me as well, like more lately, I've been really thinking in terms of like quantum physics as well. And what is quantum physics talking about when they talk about space as emergent? When we look at different reimaginings of what space is in like contemporary scientific discourse, it's interesting to see this definition shift. Just like a quick example, we can quantify what space is in certain quantum physics theories, right? They're spin networks. So we can have actual quanta of space. And you can look at the diagram. It's different dots that are connected by lines. And they said, that's space. That's it. We've drawn it, right? We have quanta of space. And so my like stupid self goes, oh, but what's in between? What's the nothingness that encapsulates this, right? But this is me being stupid, maybe, but maybe not. I don't know. But this is likewise, I think we need to ask, are we talking about the same space that we've always been talking about? Is this a new type of particle quanta, right? But are we still traditionally talking about space as simply relationship, right? A sort of nothingness, a non-being even, but that which is relational. It gives rise to multiplicity to bring it back to our Venn diagrams.
Talking about quantum mechanics, when I was in my master's program, it was probably one of my more prominent seminars that I was involved with. But in my very limited understanding of it, what I do understand is that the nature of the epistemological problems that scientists and philosophers are dealing with today bear directly upon the way that we imagine space, the problem of non-locality, for example. You know, how is it that we're able to produce these amazing results time and time again with those Stern-Gerlach machines and produce this abundance of data? And then there's this weird thing happening with probability. It tells us that spin values, you know, if they were to be measured at any time or place, basically 50-50 go one way or the other, wherever you're at in the universe. And why is that the case? And how does that probabilistic data point, how does that inform or bear upon our understanding of space? Like what kind of thing is space if this matrix of molecular matter is doing this all the time? And so, yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating place to take Bachelard's work is into quantum mechanics. Adam, I think we're going to move towards finishing up. I don't know, is there anything that you wanted to ask?
The concept of space has so many implications because if typically philosophy since Kant has been like, it hasn't thought as much about space so much as it thinks space is already operating. So that's it's literally the space to do what we're already doing because it's the condition of us doing anything in experience in the first place. I mean, thinking about the therapeutic space, that the thing so unique about psychoanalysis is you get this space separate to the world in which you can discuss these things in a new relationship, is a space defined by that relationship. But insofar as it is a space itself, you know, what we lose in it, what's being lost, or even going to Marx and the Grundrisse, like the annihilation of space by time. Space isn't what it used to be. I mean, it used to be that I, in order to talk to any of you, I'd have to get on a boat to go all the way to the States, whereas currently there's an intensive sort of space within the screen. Cyberspace is the old metaphor I used to call it, if that is still operative. And so we really need to investigate this, the concept, and I can't thank you, Catherine, for going on this, because intensive voyage into conceptual space, because it's, I mean, even especially sociologically, I mean, architecturally, the reduction of space to property as well. I mean, it's kind of, it's not, I'm not saying the final frontier so much as the first frontier we haven't quite, that limits all of our attempts to explore it there, you know, from there on, because so far we subordinated it to time, which in a way, is kind of limiting space itself. It reduces it to the space in which time happens, as opposed to the space in which space happens itself.
It also seems like you could use the poetics of space in a very evil way. Like if there's some malevolent neoliberal architects out there, like, great, we'll construct spaces that make them think they're in utopia while extracting their surplus value of their labor, or something like that, like reverse engineering anti-Oedipus or reverse engineering poetics of space. But anyway, Catherine, it was great to have you on the show. Great to meet you. Is there anything that you want to plug, endorse, or maybe tell us other great books or connections to Bachelard that we can plug into over the winter holiday?
Let's see. I really love it when it comes to Bachelard. I know you've read Psychoanalysis of Fire, Craig. That's a beautiful text. Dialectic Separation was a really huge one in my intellectual development. But if you are interested in going down the quantum physics route with Bachelard, it's just really awesome text. It's a short text. And it's only in French, but the translation is The Experience of Space in Contemporary Physics. And it's about space as evental. And so even our guy Bachelard is really on the scientific pulse. And so this is what I love so much about him, right? So he's very much a philosopher, but he's engaged in the sciences, but thinking in such a creative way that I think we can barely even categorize what he's done here in this text, or what we just really explored and discussed. And so while he's influenced so many thinkers, I think there's still more work to be done with Bachelard. Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun and so just intellectually and generative. Thank you both.
That's great. Yeah, we'll have to have you back on sometime, maybe even to talk about quantum mechanics if I have the nerve to get read up on that again. But yeah, thanks again. And everyone have a great winter solstice.